Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 13th, 2002. Today's session is with Plant Life of the North Cascades. And this is Joe Arnett that is presenting this one. Let's listen in.
That's the cord without a shape. People turn the tape on.
As a way of introduction, I'll just tell you that I know a lot of people have been to the other sessions or know me from elsewhere, but my name is Joe Arnett, and our session this afternoon is part of a series on plant life of the North Cascades. And my two focuses, or foci, I guess you'd say, in this topic have been to look at change and also to look at symbiosis. Change is how things change, how the vegetation changes over time or in response to different kinds of disturbance or different kinds of processes, natural processes of change. And symbiosis, which is what our topic is for today, is really looking at how different kinds of organisms fit together. I guess I should say that the before either of those two is the whole aspect of diversity, one of our initial interests when we go out into nature is to look at how many different kinds of plants there are. And it's kind of interesting, you think from in another kind of universe there might but just be one kind of plant. But that's not what we find at all. We find tremendous diversity. And in this valley and in the ridges around it, there's probably something on the neighborhood of around 400 species of vascular plants or higher plants. And right around the village, we might see half of those if we really took the time to look. So there's a lot of different types of life that work, not just one system that works. So diversity and change, the changes that happen on that diversity, and the third is symbiosis. How many people have been to some of the other sessions? So I know a few people, and some people are new in the village? Are new to these? Great, well welcome, glad you're here. And my job for this week and last week is to help people at whatever level they are to learn whatever they want to learn about the plant life of the place. And I have my own interest and I'll try to share my interest in a structured way. But I really like to respond to your own interest and your own questions. And so feel free to, at any time, grab me by the ear and ask me something. If that can help you out. I have three handouts here that if you didn't get them and you'd like to, feel free to take them. You won't need them for what we're talking about today. But one is a list of the conifers around the village. And this is anybody first going into the woods here. Usually the first question is, what's that plant? And usually the plants they first ask about are the trees. And so this is a list of the conifers that grow here. It's a long list. There's 16 species of conifer that grow in the valley, including the high country. Probably about 10 of those grow right around the village here. And there's some notes on each of those to help distinguish between them. And we're going to try to organize a couple, at least one walk around the village looking at these species of conifer. So help yourself to one of those if you'd like when you leave. This is a diagram of the vegetation zones of the North Cascades, which is one of the other presentations, and we'll repeat it on Tuesday. So if you'd like to take one of these, you're welcome to that too. And this is a diagram of a flower. And we'll have a session on flowering plants on, I think it's Wednesday. So if you want to learn something about flowers, we'll learn that. Another thing I always like to say is we're really looking at an infinite topic. The biological processes of nature, the diversity of nature is really, in human terms, infinite. So nobody ever knows everything. And the more you know, the more you will know that you don't know. And so I like to encourage people just to take whatever size bite they can handle in a session or a week and get some of it. Another thing I'll share with you is there's two books that I recommended for people that might be interested in plants in this area. One is called Plants of the Pacific Northwest Coast by Pojar and McKinnon. And it's a really excellent picture book that also has some identification keys, some roots, And it also has an organization by family. And if you're really interested in learning about plants, you very soon find that plant families are one of the things you want to learn right away. And there are some copies in the bookstore of this. Where we are right now is sort of on the cusp of the Eastern Cascades and Western Cascades. And so there's a very similar book made by the same publisher that's plants of the central interior of British Columbia and adjacent Washington. It looks just like this, but it's got a different title and a different cover, but it's the same format. And there's a lot of overlap. So I recommend this one, but if you're from Eastern Washington or something like that, you might want to get the central variety of this book. So how many of you are from Washington, so I can get a clue? And how many people are from Minnesota?
The two big ones.
Where else are people from?
Texas.
South Carolina.
North Carolina.
Kentucky.
All right. It's all over the place. Great. Well, a lot of the species that we'll look at, we won't find in those places, but the process is you will. And even when we look at the conifers, the genera, the bigger groups, like the pines and the firs, you will find in those places. I don't know if Texas has any true firs, but they might in the mountains in the West here.
This is Joshua tree.
That's maybe in West Texas, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that's in the lily family, actually.
Joshua tree?
I think it is. I'm not sure.
I know when we've gone to Tucson, I don't remember which state they actually the actual Joshua trees don't start in Texas. I think they're maybe in New Mexico. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Arizona.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, first of all, to start, I want to show you an outline of types of things that we might call plants. And it's a little bit of a biology class, and I don't want you to cringe on the word phylum. People had biology. I used to have a lamp that I used with a microscope that somebody had scratched on. I hate biology.
I won't tell me how many nightmares I used to have trying to cram for biology lab tests.
Yes, right. I know.
What is in that jar?
Well, it's really strange that somebody would not like biology, because biology is the study of life. Mm-hmm. And so, what could be more interesting?
It's just so hard for some
but,
of us.
You know, if you realize that biology includes everything about life, then maybe, and not just memorization of names. Although I'm kind of in the name memorization of names business.
Change it upside down.
Yeah, I can change that easily. That's that easy enough. But it's kind of like tilt this up.
Yes, you got it on the wrong side.
It probably needs flipping too.
I have a little problem. Let me put a book on. Oh, let me share this other book too, since I picked it up here. This is another book that I recommend. This is Northwest Trees by Stephen Arno. It's also in the bookstore, a couple copies unless they're both gone. It's if you're really interested in trees and you want to learn, I'm going to adjust that in a second. I'm going to put it up higher so you can see it. But the current edition has a slightly different cover, but it's the same title, Northwest Trees. And it has a great key to identification. And it also includes a lot of information about each species, its ecology, its human uses, and I've just worn my copy out. And so I recommend that one too. And that'll get us a little higher. My purpose in showing you this is that there's lots of things that are like plants. And that when I first studied biology, when I was first in college, were considered to be plants, but that in the modern classification aren't. And I just want to point this out to you because our discussion today is symbiosis, which is how two or more organisms interact in a very intimate way. And one of the interesting things about that symbiosis is very different types of organisms intimate relationships that are essential to their livelihood or may benefit their livelihood or in some cases may have detrimental effects on one of the parties. And so what we're going to look at is interactions between plants, which is right here, one of the five kingdoms in the modern classification. One of the five kingdoms of life are plants, or kingdoms is plants, one is. And two of the other major kingdoms within the higher organisms are fungi, which include toadstools and mushrooms, things that obviously look like fungi, and also things like yeast, and also things, a lot of single-cell organisms that you can't really see, or that multiple-cell organisms that mostly live an invisible life, but are very important as a decomposer, and also a component of lichens, which is one of the forms of symbiosis we'll talk about. So fungi is a whole separate kingdom. It's no longer considered a plant. And also the kingdom Protista, for our discussion, includes algae. And when I was first studying biology, algae were considered plants too. But by this scheme, they're not. And they are also a component of lichens. And so they have an ecological role in association with these others. Bacteria are a completely different kind of organism that have a very simplified physical structure. They're very small, you might ask. And, one way to visualize just how small bacteria are is if you think of this screen as being a cell of a normal plant cell being the size of the screen. Remember that normal plant cells are usually just below the limit of what we can see with our naked eye. With a hand lens, a 10x or so hand lens, we might be able to see fairly large plant cells. But if this screen was a plant cell, then a bacteria would be about the size of my hand. So they're a completely different kind of organism. And they're also one of the players in symbiosis that we'll talk about. But it's interesting to keep in mind that they're very different kinds of organisms, and they have very strong and deep connections with everything else. So in the symbiosis I'm going to talk about, mostly I'm going to talk about bacteria and fungi. One example that includes both fungi and protists. And then we'll mostly talk about what are vascular plants and their relationships with these fungi, protists, and bacteria. So it's all about relationships. If I say vascular plants, do you know what I mean? Most people know. A vascular plant is just a plant that has a tissue that's specialized for transport of water and nutrients. And so these plants up here, in my diagram here, these are plants, but they're not vascular. And because of that, they're very small. Mosses and liverworts are like a couple inches high. Because they have no tissue for transport, they have to move material around just cell to cell. So it's a very slow system. And you can imagine that anything that's bigger than that would have to have some kind of system for movement of material. And so we call those vascular plants. My area of expertise is only in vascular plants. I've studied these bryophytes a little bit, but I don't really know that much about them. Okay, so that's just to keep in mind these different kingdoms, plants, protists, fungi, and bacteria. And our story today will be talking about how those kingdoms interact. Good. So what I'm going to do is list about a half a dozen different types of symbiosis that I'll describe to you. And then I have a few slides that'll show you some examples, the visual ones. And the first one I'm going to talk about is really, in some ways, the most complicated and the most interesting, because it's a case where three different kingdoms. There are organisms in three different kingdoms that come together and actually form a symbiotic relationship within a single tissue. And these are called lichens. Is there anybody that doesn't know what a lichen is? Is there anybody that does know what a lichen is? Okay, there's one person that does know and...
They don't know,
okay.
You can point them out. Can't tell you what it is.
Yeah, okay, you can point them out. Well, that's good. Things like Spanish moss, if you're from other parts of the world, those are lichens. They're not a moss. If you remember this diagram, mosses are plants, but lichens are not plants.
What about those things in rocks that just look like they're painted on?
Those are lichens too. There's three basic kinds. There's and they're just named on their growth form. They have the same kind of relationships that I'll describe. There's called fruticose lichens, which are upright, and they have tissues that are in cylinders. And those are things like British soldiers. I don't know if you know what British soldiers are. I don't have any photographs of lichens, unfortunately. There's foliose lichens, which are leaf-like, and we have a lot of those on the west side of the mountains, where they really are a major player in the ecology of the soil, because they fall off the trees and they put nitrogen into the soil. And we also have crustose lichens, which look like they're painted on the rocks or painted on the trees. And what lichens are, is a symbiosis between, first of all, a fungus. And a fungus is one of those kingdoms that's primarily a decomposer. But a fungus grows in a thread-like form. Sometimes that thread-like form is in the soil and invisible, and sometimes it's in rotting wood, big decomposer. And fungi have what's called external digestion, which doesn't sound all that appealing. But what the fungi does is it secretes acid, different kinds of enzymes and acids, which decomposes the material around it, and then it absorbs the nutrient after it's been broken down. So it all does that external to its own body. And so it grows in a thread-like form called the mycelium. Well, in a lichen, that thread-like form is very compacted. Just like in a mushroom, when you see a mushroom that you eat, that's made of mycelium. I don't know if you want this. I hate to use too many technical words because that's one of the things that people hate about biology, but it is this thread-like form. And it forms the mushrooms that you eat. But in a lichen, it's formed into a tissue that's quite compact. And I'll draw a foliose lichen in this case. And so the fungus forms the body of the lichen. The lichens you see in the trees or growing on the crusts in the rocks, those are the mycelium of the fungus. And then it is also plus a bacteria. Or an algae. So remember, the bacteria are very small, single cells. Well, some of the bacteria are called blue-green bacteria. And they're able to photosynthesize. So they're able to take sunlight and water and carbon dioxide, and with the energy in sunlight convert that carbon dioxide and water into sugar. Very simple chemical reaction that's really the basis for all life. Because
is that kind of our first kind of plant-like activity, is when algae started photosynthesis?
Probably it was bacteria.
Bacteria?
That were photosynthesizing. Probably the first photosynthesis that happened was bacteria. You've probably heard the term blue-green algae, but by our classification system, algae are these big cells like the size of a screen, you know, relative to bacteria. Bacteria are completely different and simple and small, so we call them blue-green bacteria instead of blue-green algae. But the point for our discussion is that they're photosynthetic, and they're able to produce food. And this food that's produced by the bacterium, in this case blue-green blueberry bacteria provides the food that is then used by the fungus. And the algae, which is a green algae, which is one of those large cell type of higher organism, also can do that and carry out photosynthesis. So either the algae or the bacteria, or in some cases both, and it depends on the type of lichen, they carry out photosynthesis and produce food and supply it to the fungus. And the fungus, in turn, provides the mycelium, which provides a habitat for those algae or bacteria to grow. Yeah?
What makes the algae, remember, the protistas, obviously?
Yeah.
It's not a plant.
What makes it not a plant?
Yeah.
It has to do primarily with the life cycle, where there's stages in the life cycle which are single-celled, and those single-celled organisms are, in some cases, that's the whole life cycle of the algae. It's a single cell that lives its whole life as a single cell. And there's other microscopic structural differences in the cell wall, which I can't really tell you as much about because I don't know as much about. But they're sufficiently different from the higher plants that they're considered a separate kingdom. And even in the big seaweeds, those are also considered protists, because even though we see a big multicellular growth form, that there's a stage in the life cycle which is single cell and free living. And so that's considered to be a fundamental enough difference to separate it from the higher plants. It's about all I can tell, because I haven't really studied the protists much. But I do know that that they are separated into a separate kingdom, and that they are also fundamentally different. Protists also include things that really don't fit in any bags, like, remember paramecium from where you might have studied biology? There are things that swim around, so they act like an animal. We think of animals as being modal. And they also photosynthesize, which is what we think of with plants. So if you only had plants and animals, would you put that in as a plant or an animal? Well, it's not really either. And so people who classify things have put them in this kingdom protista, which I understand is kind of a garbage can catch-all, because there's so much diversity that, you know, we're classifiers and we like to put things in categories, but the protists just don't fit the categories very well. So these single-cell bacteria and or algae live within the tissue of this fungus. Now there aren't, on this side of the mountain, so I've been looking around to see what we have for good examples of lichens. And the best example that I've seen is, if you look in the trees around the village, some of the, especially Douglas firs where I've seen it, in bundles of pine, you see this bright yellowish orange kind of growth on the bark in some places. And that's an example of a lichen. Maybe when we go on some of the walks, we'll have to make a special effort to see what examples do we have of these lichens. But the main ecological contribution that lichens make is distinct from this symbiosis that's going on, is that they are, if they include these bacteria, they are also nitrogen fixers. And we're going to see this come up again in another type of symbiosis. But if you think of yourself, think of your own physical body, in every one of your cells there's proteins and there's nucleic acids, DNA, you know, our genetic material. Every amino acid and every protein has nitrogen in it. And every subcomponent of our DNA has nitrogen in it. It's one of the chemical elements that's essential for those compounds. But there's very little nitrogen that we can obtain. Even though we live in an atmosphere that's like 78% nitrogen, we are not able to obtain that directly. The only natural sources of that nitrogen in the atmosphere getting into a form that we can use is through one of the routes is through bacteria. So there are some bacteria that are able to take nitrogen and convert it into a chemical form we can use. And it's my understanding in the natural systems, the bacteria are the number one converter of nitrogen. So even though we can't see these organisms and they're a micron in size, they're an essential part of our survival. Another source of nitrogen being fixed is lightning in the atmosphere. Apparently a certain amount of nitrogen is converted by lightning.
And so then you just breathe it in?
No, it's converted into amino acids, and then it's in our diet.
I see.
It's a real complex chemistry, because if you know nitrogen in the air is
N2.
It's N2, and those two atoms of nitrogen are really hard to break apart. It takes a huge amount of energy. And in the natural systems, these bacteria are the only organisms that have figured out how to do that. If I can anthropomorphize.
Lightning goes to NO2.
Pardon?
Not from the lightning, it goes to NO2. Rains down.
Okay.
And you need either NO2 or NO3 for the plants to start picking it up.
Right, so it's converted into a nitrate or nitrite. I was told the other day that in our modern age that 30% of our nitrogen now comes from nitrogen fertilizer, which is chemically synthesized, where we use a lot of fossil fuel energy to break apart that N2. So that's in the modern age, that's the third source, and probably the biggest one. Well, it'd have to be second in order. The bacteria would be number one, number two would be our own chemical conversion.
But they also say that's what's ruining our waterways and such.
Well, that if you have the converted form, the nitrates, then you have too much of it, then it's fertilizer for...
Just excess, just leaches down through the water, that's the problem.
Right, gets in the water, and then it's fertilizer for algae and bacteria growing in the water, so it becomes a problem. But in most natural systems, nitrogen is the limiting nutrient. It's the one that's in the least supply. So that's a role of lightness, number one. There's two more that are sort of on the chemical scale that I just want to mention. And one of those has to do with the same thing. It's nitrogen fixing bacteria. And its ecological role is the same thing, that they're bacteria that associate with the roots of plants and convert atmospheric nitrogen so that the plant can use it. You probably all know about growing legumes or growing cover crops of clover. Well, clover has a symbiotic relationship. And I'll say clover, etc., because there's lots of things like clover that have the same relationship. Clover plus a bacterium is called rhizobium. That's just the type of bacteria. But that's a major source of nitrogen fixing. And in around here, the native plants that are probably most important in this regard are alders. Plus, so there's an actinomycin. Just to point out that they're different, that there's a lot of diversity in these bacteria too. But their main role and the main significance is that they're nitrogen fixing. Now I know if you want to learn about the plants of Holden, maybe nitrogen fixing bacteria doesn't come into your, probably not the first thing you think about. When you think, oh, I'd like to learn about the plants of Holden. And now you're learning about bacteria and chemistry of atmosphere and soil. And but if you walk out the road, and I didn't notice any around here. I was trying to bring you in one to show you, but I didn't see any when I walked around the village. If you walk down the road here where there's slide alder growing around, and you find a little seedling in the road, and it's okay to do this in the road because the roads they have to maintain. If you pull that up and look at the roots, you'll see that there's these little bumps on the roots. Just like if you go out in a clover patch or in a farm field that has clover or vetch and pull it up and look at the roots, you'll see little nodules on the roots. And it's sort of an insignificant little thing, but that those nodules are where bacteria are growing. And they're converting atmospheric nitrogen into a form that the plants can use. And if we didn't have that, we'd lose essentially all of our nitrogen out of the natural system. We didn't have fertilizer factories. And these systems up here, those alders, that's the role that they play. And there's some other kinds of plants that do that too, but alders are the most common and the one that is growing in the road so you can appropriately pull one up and look at it. So nitrogen fixing bacteria. Now here's another one that is often confused. The reason it's often confused is that they also are invisible or nearly invisible, and they also grow in the soil. But the vast majority of the higher plants, the vascular plants, from that use that term, have associations with fungi and their roots. And these fungi act as an extension of the root system, which benefit the plant, enable the plant to take up more nutrient and more water. And there's a classic forestry experiment of taking a sterile medium, which doesn't have any of these fungi in the soil, and planting conifers, and then taking the same medium that has been inoculated with this fungus. And the growth rate is there's a pronounced difference in growth rate. Conifers will grow without these fungi, but if they have the fungi, their growth rate is greatly accelerated. So we often think of things like fungus as being a disease, which is a negative effect. But in this case, the fungi is a beneficial effect. So it's easy to confuse these two, as I say, because they're both invisible in the soil. If you think of this one as being as producing nitrogen through a bacteria, and think of this one as being sort of like an extension of the root system, then maybe that helps them be separate. Remember how the mycelium of a fungus grows, it's thread-like growth. Well, it can grow out through the soil and then plug into the roots of the higher plants and act as a conduit for nutrient and water. Well, what this does in our discussion anyway is it sort of sets the groundwork for this next thing I want to talk about, which is called saprophytes. And this is where you actually get to see a plant. So somewhere in here you'll see a real plant. And if you've managed to follow any of this discussion of things I've been trying to say, you might be able to see this saprophyte or this plant with a whole new understanding. These are plants that don't photosynthesize. They don't make any of their own food. We think of plants as being green and making food, and that's how they grow. And these are plants that don't do that. They don't have any green leaves, and they're able to get their nutrients from some other way, from some other source. And what that source is sort of a three-parted symbiosis. The first thing you have, I'll draw it this way. This is the saprophyte. I'll draw several. And under the ground, the roots of the plant grow, like plant roots do. And underground, they're connected to a fungus. which grows through the soil as a mycelium and acts as an extension of the root system. And then these are in turn connected to, I'm going to draw it all the way over here so we can see the thing. They're connected to a green plant, most often a conifer.
A conifer, you say?
Yeah. This is my idea of a pine tree, or a Douglas fir, or a hemlock tree. We'll make it a hemlock. Hemlocks have a drooping leader. In fact, in our conifer discussion, if I drew this and I say, what kind of tree is this? Even though my drawing is lousy, you can tell that's a that's a hemlock, because hemlock has a drooping leader. So those roots grow in the soil. And they are photosynthetic. And so we have this this cycling here of the photosynthesis, the products of photosynthesis, or the food, sugar, produced by the plant, goes down into the roots. It gets picked up by the fungus. And it's really a form of three-way parasitism, that this saprophyte is parasitizing this green tree through the medium of the fungus. Now, we call them saprophytes because people used to think that they lived off dead material, like a fungus does. You know, fungus is a decomposer. It grows in rotting wood, and it's able to grow and put up mushrooms and all that kind of thing. People thought that that's probably what saprophytes did, because they obviously weren't producing their own food. But it turns out that it's a much more complicated story underground.
A daughter works on the surface, though.
Yeah, now a daughter is a real parasite. Just see if I have time to do this. I'll give you another little set of terminology. You know, biologists love to classify things. Probably why whoever was in that class hated biology. But just so you understand, in symbiosis, there's three basic types. But they're all symbiosis because they're all things living close together in intimate relationship. The first type is called mutualism. This is just to give you a bunch of isms to try to digest. Mutualism is where both or all the players benefit. So a mutual benefit, which you would expect with the name mutualism.
Sounds like a stockbroker.
Yeah, insurance.
Okay, I hear those people, economists talk, I don't understand that at all. So, but mutualism, yeah, it does sound kind of like some kind of an economic thing. The next one is commensalism.
That sounds political.
And that's a case where one of the players benefits. And one has no effect. In other words, it's a neutral relationship. Like that lichen growing on the bark of the tree out here. The lichen is benefited because it gets a place, the right habitat. It's growing on this bark. It's up in the light. It's away from the forest floor. It benefits. It appears to have no effect on the tree. So it's not parasitism. Well, I have to do number three. In parasitism, as you're going to imagine, one benefits, one of the players benefits, and one is harmed. So you mentioned daughter. This is daughter. daughter is a flowering plant. It's hard to see the flowers, but it's a flowering plant that parasitizes green plants.
Mistletoe.
Mistletoe is another flowering plant that also parasitizes green plants. Either, well, they're usually specific to one species or another. Like there are mistletoes that affect oaks, there are mistletoes that affect the ponderosa pine, western hemlock. Those are parasites. I'll tell you some other parasites you might not have thought of. Indian paintbrush is a parasite. Now, Indian paintbrush is also photosynthetic. So it produces part of its own food, and part of it is through a parasitism of other plants.
Just any particular one, or just?
I actually don't know. In that case, I don't know the host. Some of the other examples, I'll show you some slides.
Texas, we have bluebonnets, and the Indian paintbrushes do take over a field of bluebonnets.
Oh, is that right?
And parasitizes them. But I don't know that you have that kind of plant.
It's the same genus. Yeah, it's another name for. So I'll have to pay attention to that. Actually, I haven't noticed. I've always known that, or I've always been told that Indian paintbrush was a root parasite. But I've never paid much attention to its host.
I think I read an article about it in one of the Texas Highways magazine or something, but you can lose all your parts.
Somebody was saying that you can't transplant Indian paintbrush because you take it away from something else it needs.
Right.
So I guess that...
Yeah, that's why it's hard to transplant.
What is it dependent on?
I don't know. Actually, I don't know what the host is in that case. So I'll give you some examples in nature. There's two main families of saprophytes. And I'll actually show you a picture of a real plant here. The two main families are the orchid family. We have lots of orchids here, and there's several of them that are saprophytes that are able to survive through this three-parted symbiosis. The other one is the heath family. And the heath family includes things like huckleberries, blueberries, heather. Well, some of those are also parasites, not all of them. They all do have, both of these families appear to have, in all cases, association with fungus, mycorrhizal fungi. And that, particularly in the orchid family, enables the seed to germinate. Seeds won't even germinate without this relationship with fungus. But there are, and all of the heath family appear to have some kind of mycorrhizal fungi. But there are individuals that are parasites. And through this this saprophytic relationship. So let me, I'm going to have to hide the board here, but I'll show you some photos of those. And if you could close that screen, that would be, that window shade, that would be great. Darken it just a little bit more. Just shifting on the projector. Or actually, if you don't know where the projector goes, I can refer to my mount for the day. Okay. But sit down. So. The nice thing about standing up and talking is it's harder to fall asleep. You know, these late afternoons, but here. Let's go. Oh, that is. I don't know what's doing this on its own.
It's puzzling.
But it is.
It is doing it.
Maybe
it's
sitting on the clicker.
Is there an automatic
over?
Yeah.
Yeah, there must be.
It
Well, stop. Let's back up and see if maybe it'll let us. Okay, now just stop right there. Now this
section.
Yeah, this is this Indian pipe, or sometimes called ghost pipe, because it's pure white, and it's grows in the valley. I haven't seen it around Holden. Have you, Carol, seen it around here?
I've seen it somewhere in this area, but I can't remember where.
Talk fast, Joe.
Not in this valley, I don't
think. Let's see. I adjusted the pace. So let's see if this back still works. Okay, maybe we go fast enough. So anyway, it's in the heath family, and it's got no photosynthesis. It's not able to make any of its own food. It's associated with a fungus in the soil, and that fungus is associated with conifers around it, or at least with photosynthetic plants around it. So I don't think ecologically it has a profound effect on the system, as far as I can tell. But it... I know there's a way to fix that, but I don't have it. But it's kind of an oddity, I guess, in a way. Curiosity about nature. Something that tells us something about how things interact. That's how I view it myself. About the complexity of those interactions. This is called candy stripes. And it's a member of the same family. It's another species that has the same relationship. This individual is getting a little dried up. But it's really quite a striking plant with its red and white stripes. You can see why it's called candy stripe. Or maybe you could call it the peppermint stick.
These relatively short plants.
Yes, they're all pretty small plants. They're all herbaceous, you know, a foot or two tall. With one exception, the last one is quite a tall one. This is an orchid, another family, and this is called phantom orchid. And this was probably taken right across the lake here. There is some phantom orchid growing along there. And I don't know if it's also found up in the valley here, but it probably is. But it's a pure white plant, totally dependent upon other plants to get its nutrient. This is called a coral root orchid. And this one does grow around here. This is showing an unusual form of it. Usually it's red like this. This is the same species. But it's, I'm just going to have to keep going back here. The one on the right, for some reason, has this yellowish cast, some genetic difference. But up by the ballpark, if you just go into the woods around the ballpark, there's a whole lot of this spotted coral root growing around in there. And it's an orchid, and it's got this saprophytic relationship with the roots. This is a close-up. It's about a coral root orchid.
Are most of these edible?
I don't know that any of these are edible. I'm always cautious about telling people what they can eat and they can't. But I've never actually heard of people eating them, although vanilla is an orchid, so it may well be. They're usually in such small incidence that, you know, if they're edible, it's not something very abundant. This is another member of the heath family. It's called pine sap. And you know, you can see by this Douglas fir cone with the size of, they're usually pretty small plants. And this is the big one. And I'll focus this a little bit. This is one of the more dramatic ones, I think. In that it's one of the biggest ones. And this is called pine drops, or Andromeda. And it can grow to be over 5 feet high. This way you get a preview, you know, what's coming next. But it's in the heath family. It's got fruits that look just like some of the other members of that family. A little stretch to think of this being a relative of a blueberry, but that's what it is. And this one does grow really large. Now there's a couple of photos here of actual parasites. This is called broomrape, and it's a little tiny plant about 2 inches high, and it parasitizes stonecrop. It's
Stonecroft is a kind of a succulent rock garden plant around here. And this is totally dependent. It has no photosynthesis of its own. Oh, there's another. We don't need those. We saw those already. Another shot of the broom rake.
Glossy circles.
And this is another type of coral root orchid. This one is called striped coral root. The other one is spotted. And I put this in as a last photo just to show you that even a lot of the green plants, this is called pink pyrola, and it's growing profusely along the trail. If you start up the Heart Lake Trail, you don't have to go very far. It's pretty low down. This grows along the trail. And it's not evident if you just look at it. It's a green plant, although you can't see it right now because it's disappearing. This is a way to keep my talk brief so that you can get out of here and go to dinner. It has green leaves, photosynthetic, but in the soil, this has association with fungi, which we think is an obligate relationship. It has to have a fungus in order to successfully grow, which is why they're pretty hard to transplant and hard to grow in the garden. And there's the genus is Pyrola. There's several species around here of Pyrola. And just what I wanted to tell you is that even though this one is green, and there's several species that are green and have their own photosynthesis, occasionally you find individuals that are pure white, that they've lost the ability to photosynthesize. And so this ability to revert into the saprophytic relationship seems to be abroad in that family. That it's not just in one species, that it overlaps into other species. So I'll back that up just for that'll be my final photo. And I'll turn this off before it's just gonna go dark, so it won't be give us a little amusement, I guess. Antics of the living slide projector. it's still doing this
stuff. Yes, it is.
All right, so that's a little picture of some of the intricacies of the natural world. And I think there are great lessons to be learned by going out and seeing what the world is really like. And maybe this is somehow relates to this idea of wilderness. You know, wilderness means lots of different things to different people. And in our biblical stories, wilderness is sort of something that appears to be hostile. You know, we don't think of going into the wilderness as something the Hebrew people did for recreation or that Christ did in order to have a good, you know, vacation. But some of its characteristics also had to do with the fact that it was without human action, without human involvement. And there's something about going into nature that I think we do learn by seeing something that lives without our involvement. And so maybe that's part of the reason that many people are attracted to nature, that they like to experience on some level how the world operates without our involvement.
What we haven't messed up yet.
What we haven't messed up. Of course, there is nowhere that we haven't messed up or that we haven't affected. I won't say messed up, but you know, we do have this profound influence in the world, and for good or ill. So anyway. That's the end of our presentation. And
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for coming. I hope that if you're interested in plants, that you come to some of the others, because we do look at more plants. And we have some opportunity for hands-on identification and that kind of thing. So, thank you very much.